3. Changing Tides. 1. Red London. The nightmare started as it always did, with Kell standing in the middle of a public place, sometimes the stone's throw, or the statue garden in front of the Dane's fortress, or the London sanctuary, at once surrounded and alone. Tonight he was in the middle of the night market. It was crowded, more crowded than Kell had ever seen it. The people pressed shoulder to shoulder along the riverbank. He thought he saw Rye at the other end, but by the time he called his brother's name, the prince had vanished into the crowd. Nearby, he glimpsed a girl with dark hair cut short along her jaw, and called out, "Lila!" But as soon as he took a step toward her, the crowd rippled and swallowed her again. Everyone was familiar, and everyone was a stranger in the shifting mass of bodies. And then a shock of white hair caught his eye, the pale figure of Athos Dane sliding like a serpent through the crowd. Kell growled and reached for his knife, only to be interrupted by cold fingers closing over his. "Flower boy," cooed a voice in his ear, and he spun to find Astrid, covered in cracks as if someone had pieced her shattered body back together. Kell staggered back, but the crowd was getting even thicker now, and someone shoved him from behind. By the time he regained his balance, both the Danes were gone. Rye flickered again in the distance. He was looking around as if searching for someone, mouthing a word, a name Kell couldn't hear. Another stranger bumped into Kell hard. "Sorry," he murmured. "Sorry." But the words echoed, and the people kept pushing past him as if they didn't see him, as if he wasn't there. And then, as soon as he thought it, everybody stopped mid-stride, and every face turned toward him, features resolving into gruesome masks of anger and fear and disgust. "I'm sorry," he said again, holding up his hands, only to see his veins turning black. "No," he whispered as the magic traced lines up his arms. "No, please, no." He could feel the darkness humming in his blood as it spread. The crowd began to move again, but instead of walking away, they were all coming toward him. "Get back," he said, and when they didn't, he tried to run, only to discover that his legs wouldn't move. "Too late," came Holland's voice from nowhere, everywhere. "Once you let it in, you've already lost." The magic forced its way through him with every beat of his heart. Kell tried to fight it back, but it was in his head now, whispering in Vitari's voice. "Let me in." Pain shot jaggedly through Kell's chest as the darkness hit his heart, and in the distance, Rye collapsed.
"No!"
Kell shouted, reaching toward his brother uselessly, desperately. But as his hand brushed the nearest person, the darkness leaped like fire from his fingers to the man's chest. He shuddered and then collapsed, crumbling to ash as his body struck the street stones. Before he hit the ground, the people on either side of him began to fall as well, death rippling in a wave through the crowd, silently consuming everyone. Beyond them, the buildings began to crumble too, and the bridges, and the palace, until Kell was standing alone in an empty world. And then, in the silence, he heard a sound, not a sob or a scream, but a laugh. And it took him a moment to recognize the voice. It was his. Kell gasped, lurching forward out of sleep. Light was filtering through the patio doors, glinting off a fresh dusting of snow. The shards of sun made him cringe and look away as he pressed his palm to his chest and waited for his heart to slow. He'd fallen asleep in his chair, fully clothed, his skull aching from his brother's indulgences. "Damn it, Rye," he muttered, pushing himself to his feet. His head was pounding, a sound matched by whatever was going on outside his window. The blows he, well, Rye, had sustained the night before were a memory, but the after-effect of the drinks was compounding, and Kell decided then and there that he vastly preferred the sharp short pain of a wound to the dull protracted ache of a hangover. He felt like death, and as he splashed cold water on his face and throat and got dressed, he could only hope that the prince felt worse. Outside his door, a stiff-looking man with graying temples stood watch. Kel winced. He always hoped for Hostra. Instead, he usually got Staff, the one who hated him. "Morning," said Kel, walking past. "Afternoon, sir," answered Staff, or Silver, as Rye had nicknamed the aging royal guard, as he fell in step behind him. Kel wasn't thrilled by the appearance of Staff or Hostra in the aftermath of the Black Knight, but he wasn't surprised either. It wasn't the guard's fault that King Maxim no longer trusted his Antari, just like it wasn't Kel's fault that the guards couldn't always keep track of him. He found Rye in the sunroom, a courtyard enclosed by glass, having lunch with the king and queen. The prince seemed to be managing his own hangover with surprising poise, though Kel could feel Rye's headache throbbing alongside his own, and Kel noted that the prince sat with his back to the panes of glass and the glinting light beyond.
"Kel," Rye said brightly, "I was beginning to think you'd sleep all day."
"Sorry," said Kel pointedly. "I must have indulged a little too much last night."
"Good afternoon, Kel," said Queen Emira,
an elegant woman with skin like polished wood and a circlet of gold resting atop her jet-black hair. Her tone was kind but distant, and it felt like it had been weeks since she'd last reached out and touched his cheek. In truth, it had been longer, nearly 4 months since the Black Knight, when Kel had let the Black Stone into the city, and Vitari had swept through the streets, and Astrid Dane had plunged a dagger into Rye's chest, and Kel had given a piece of his life to bring him back.
"Where is our son?"
the queen had demanded, as if she had only one.
"I hope you're well rested,"
said King Maxim, glancing up from the sheaf of papers in front of him.
"I am, sir."
Fruit and bread were piled on the table, and as Kel slid into the empty chair, a servant appeared with a silver pitcher and poured him a steaming cup of tea. He finished the cup in a single burning swallow, and the servant considered him, then left the pitcher, a small gesture for which Kel was immeasurably grateful. Two more people were seated at the table, a man and a woman, both dressed in shades of red and each with a gold pin of the Maresh seal, the chalice and rising sun, fastened to their shoulder. The pin marked the figures as friends of the crown. It permitted them full access to the palace and instructed any servants and guards to not only welcome but assist them.
"Parlo, Lisan,"
said Kel in greeting. They were the Ostra selected to help organize the tournament, and Kel felt like he had seen more of them in the past few weeks than he had the king and queen.
"Master Kel,"
they said in unison, tipping their heads with practiced smiles and calculated propriety. A map of the palace and surrounding grounds was spread across the table, one edge tucked beneath a plate of tarts, another under a teacup, and Lisan was gesturing to the south wing.
"We've arranged for Prince Cole and Princess Cora to stay here, in the Emerald Suite. Fresh flowers will be grown there the day before they arrive."
Rye made a face at Kel across the table. Kel was too tired to try to read it.
"Lord Solinar, meanwhile," continued Lisan, "will be housed in the Western Conservatory. We've stocked it with coffee, just as you instructed, and—"
"And what of the Vescan Queen?" grumbled Maxim. "Or the Faroan King? Why do they not grace us with their presence? Do they not trust us? Or do they simply have better things to do?"
Emira frowned.
"The emissaries they've chosen are appropriate,"
Rai scoffed.
"Queen Lastra of Vesk has 7 children, mother. I doubt it's much of an inconvenience for her to loan us 2. As for the Faroans, Lord Solinar is a known antagonist who's spent the last 2 decades stirring up discontent wherever he goes, hoping it will spark enough conflict to dethrone his brother and seize control of Faro."
"Since when are you so invested in imperial politics?" asked Kel, already on his 3rd cup of tea. To his surprise, Rye shot him a scowl.
"I'm invested in my kingdom, brother," he snapped. "You should be too."
"I'm not their prince," observed Kel. He was in no mood for Rye's attitude. "I'm just the one who has to clean up his messes."
"Oh,"
seeing as you've made none of your own?"
They held each other's gazes. Kel resisted the urge to stab a fork into his own leg just to watch his brother wince. What was happening to them? They'd never been cruel to each other before, but pain and pleasure weren't the only things that seemed to transfer with the bond. Fear, annoyance, anger, all plucked at the binding spell, reverberating between them, amplifying. Rye had always been fickle, but now Kel felt his brother's ever-shifting temperament, the constant oscillation, and it was maddening. Space meant nothing. They could be standing side by side or London's apart. There was no escape. More and more, the bond felt like a chain. Ymira cleared her throat.
"I think the Eastern Conservatory would be better for Lord Solinar. It gets better light.
But what about the attendants? The Veskins always travel with a full complement."
The Queen soothed the table, guiding the conversation deftly away from the brothers' rising moods, but there were too many unspoken things in the air, making it stuffy. Kel pushed himself to his feet and turned to leave.
"Where are you going?"
asked Maxim, handing his papers to an attendant. Kel turned back.
"I was going to oversee the construction on the floating arenas, Your Highness."
"Rye can handle that," said the King. "You have an errand to run."
With that, he held out an envelope. Kel didn't realize how eager he was to go, to escape not only the palace, but this city, this world, until he saw that slip of paper. It bore no address, but he knew exactly where he was meant to take it. With the White London throne empty, and the city plunged into crown warfare for the first time in 7 years, communication had been suspended. Kel had gone only once, in the weeks after the Dane twins fell, and had nearly lost his life to the violent masses, after which it was decided that Kel would let White London alone for a time until things settled. That left only Grey London, the simple, magicless realm, all coal smoke and sturdy old stone.
"I'll go now," said Kel, crossing to the King's side.
"Mind the regent, Prince," warned the King. "These correspondences are a matter of tradition, but the man's questions have grown prodding."
Kel nodded. He had often wanted to ask King Maxim what he thought of the Grey London leader, and wondered about the contents of his letters, whether the Prince Regent asked as many questions of his neighboring crown as he did of Kel.
"He inquires often about magic," he told the King. "I do my best to dissuade him."
Maxim grunted.
"He is a foolish man. Be careful."
Kel raised a brow. Was Maxim actually worried for his safety? But then as he reached for the letter, he saw the flicker of distrust in the King's eyes, and his spirits sank. Maxim kept grudges like scars. They faded by degrees, but always left a mark. Kel knew he'd brought it on himself. For years he'd used his expeditions as royal liaison to transport forbidden items between the worlds. If he hadn't developed his reputation as a smuggler, the Black Stone would never have found its way into his hands, would never have killed men and women and brought havoc to Red London. Or perhaps the Danes would still have found a way, but they wouldn't have used Kel to do it. He'd been a pawn and a fool, and now he was paying for it, just as Rye was forced to pay for his own part, for the possession charm that had let Astrid Dane take up residence in his body. In the end, they were both to blame. But the King still loved Rye. The Queen could still look at him. Ymira held out a second, smaller envelope, the note for King George. A courtesy, more than anything else, but the fragile King clung to these correspondences, and so did Kel. The ailing King had no idea how short they were getting, and Kel had no intention of letting him know. He'd taken to elaborating, spinning intimate yarns about the Arnesian King and Queen, the Prince's exploits, and Kel's own life in the palace. Perhaps this time he'd tell George about the tournament. The King would love that. He took the notes and turned to go, already pulling together what he'd say, when Maxim stopped him.
"What about your point of return?"
Kel stiffened imperceptibly. The question was like a short tug, a reminder that he was now being kept on a leash.
The door will be at the mouth of Narish Kas, just off the southern edge of the night market.
The king glanced at Staff, who hung back by the door to make sure he'd heard, and the guard nodded once.
"Don't be late," ordered Maxim.
Kel turned away and left the royal family to their talk of tournament visitors and fresh linens and who preferred coffee or wine or strong tea. At the sunroom doors, he cast a glance back and found Rye looking at him with an expression that might have been, "I'm sorry," but also could have been, "fuck off." Or at the very least, "we'll talk later." Kel let the matter go and escaped, slipping the letters into the pocket of his coat. He walked briskly through the palace halls, back to his chambers, and through to the smaller second room beyond, closing the door behind him. Rye probably would have used such an alcove to hold boots or coat pins, but Kel had transformed the space into a small but well-stocked library, holding the texts he'd collected on magic. They were as much philosophical as practical, many gifted by Master Tyrion or borrowed from the royal library, as well as some journals of his own scribbled with thoughts on Antari blood magic, about which so little was known. One slim black volume he'd dedicated to Vitari, the black magic he'd grasped, awakened, destroyed the year before. That journal held more questions than answers. On the back of the library's wooden door were half a dozen hand-drawn symbols, each simple but distinct, shortcuts to other places in the city, carefully drawn in blood. Some were faded from disuse, others fresh. One of the symbols, a circle with a pair of crossed lines drawn through it, led to Tyrion's sanctuary on the opposite bank. As Kel traced his fingers over the mark, he vividly remembered helping Lila haul a dying Rye through the door. Another mark had once led to Kel's private chamber at the Ruby Fields, the only place in London that had been truly his. Now it was nothing more than a smudge. Kel scanned the door until he found the symbol he was looking for, a star made of three intersecting lines. This mark came with its own memories, of an old king in a cell of a room, his gnarled fingers curled around a single red coin as he murmured about fading magic. Kel drew his dagger from its place under the cuff of his coat and grazed his wrist. Blood welled, rich and red, and he dabbed the cut and drew the mark fresh. When it was done, he pressed his hand flat against the symbol and said, "Astassen." "Transfer." And then he stepped forward. The world softened and warped around his hand, and he passed from the darkened alcove into sunlight, crisp and bright enough to revive the fading ache behind his eyes. Kel was no longer in his makeshift library, but standing in a well-appointed courtyard. He wasn't in grey London, not yet, but in an Ostra's garden in an elegant village called Disan. Significant not because of its fine fruit trees or glass statues, but because it occupied the same ground in Red London that Windsor Castle did in Grey. The same exact ground. Traveling magic only worked two ways. Kel could either transfer between two different places in one world, or travel between the same place in different ones. And because they kept the English king at Windsor, which sat well outside the city of London, he had to make his way first to Ostra Pavaron's garden. It was a bit of clever navigation on Kel's part, not that anyone knew enough of Antari magic to appreciate it. Holland might have, but Holland was dead, and he'd likely had a network of acrosses and betweens intricate enough to make Kel's own attempts look childish. The winter air whipped around him, and he shivered as he drew the letters out of his pocket with his unbloodied hand, then turned the coat inside out and outside in until he found the side he was looking for, a black knee-length garment with a hood and velvet lining. Fit for grey London, where the cold always felt colder, bitter and damp in a way that seeped through cloth and skin. Kel shrugged the new coat on and tugged the letters deep into one of the pockets. They were lined with softened wool instead of silk, blew out a plume of warm breath and marked the icy wall with the blood from his hand. But then, as he was reaching for the cord of tokens around his neck, something tugged at his attention. He paused and looked around, considering the garden. He was alone, truly alone, and he found himself wanting to savor it. Aside from one trip north when he and Rye were boys, this was the farthest Kell ever strayed from the city. He'd always been watched, but he'd felt more confined in the past 4 months than in the nearly 20 years he'd served the crown. Kell used to feel like a possession. Now he felt like a prisoner. Perhaps he should have run when he'd had the chance. "You could still run," said a voice in his ear. It sounded suspiciously like Lila. In the end, she had escaped. Could he? He didn't have to run to another world. What if he simply walked away? Away from the garden and the village, away from the city. He could take a coach or a boat to the ocean, and then what? How far would he make it with almost no money of his own and an eye that marked him as an Antari? "You could take what you need," said the voice. It was a very big world, and he'd never even seen it. If he stayed in Arnes, he would eventually be found. And if he fled into Pharaoh, or Vesk? The Pharaohans saw his eye as a mark of strength, nothing more. But Kell had heard his name paired with a Veskan word, Krata, pillar. As if he alone held up the Arnesian Empire. And if either empire got their hands on him... Kell stared down at his blood-streaked hand. Saints, how could he actually consider running away? It was madness, the idea that he could, that he would, abandon his city, his king and queen, his brother. He'd betrayed them once, well, one crime, albeit committed many times, and it had nearly cost him everything. He wouldn't forsake them again, no matter what restlessness had been awakened in him. "You could be free," insisted the voice. But that was the thing. Kell would never be free, no matter how far he fled. He'd given up freedom with his life when he handed it to Rye. "Enough," he said aloud, silencing the doubts as he dug the proper cord out from under his collar and tugged it over his head. On the strap hung a copper coin, the face rubbed smooth from years of use. "Enough," he thought, and then he brought his bloody hand to the garden wall. He had a job to do. "Us traverse." Travel. The world began to bend around the words and the blood and the magic, and Kell stepped forward, hoping to leave behind his troubles with his London, trade them for a few minutes with the king. But as soon as his boots settled on the castle carpet, he realized that his problems were just beginning. Instantly, Kell knew that something was wrong. Windsor was too quiet, too dark. The bowl of water that usually waited for him in the antechamber was empty, the candles to either side unlit. When he listened for the sound of steps, he heard them, distantly, in the halls behind him. But from the chamber ahead, he was met with silence. Dread crept in as he made his way into the king's sitting room, hoping to see his withered frame sleeping in his high-backed chair, or hear his frail, melodic voice. But the room was empty. The windows were fastened shut against the snow, and there was no fire going in the hearth. The room was cold and dark in a closed-up way. Kell went to the fireplace and held out his hands as if to warm them, and an instant later flames licked up across the empty grate. The fire wouldn't last long, fueled by nothing more than air and magic, but in its light Kell crossed through the space, searching for signs of recent occupation. Cold tea, a cast-off shawl. But the room felt abandoned, unlived in. And then his gaze caught on the letter. If it could be called a letter. A single piece of crisp cream paper, folded and propped on the tray before the fire, with his name written on the front in the Prince Regent's steady, confident script. Kell took up the note, knowing what he would find before he unfolded the page, but he still felt ill as the words danced in the enchanted fire's light. The king is dead.